Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar, our last for the month of August. And I have to say, I'm beginning to be depressed already about the end of summer, but that's for later. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. Our guest today is Mark Meyerowitz, and our focus is Turkey, which I think we don't pay enough attention to. So I'm really happy to have Mark with us. We are specifically going to talk about Turkey's role in Syria, in the ouster of Bashar Assad and Iran, and Turkey's support for Ahmed al-Shara, also known as al-Jolani. We can probably get Mark to talk about Turkey's renewed and increasing anti-Israel posture as well. First, your JPC commercial. The Jewish Policy Center was established in 1985. That's 40 years ago, which I have to say surprises me. You can find us on our website at jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can sign up for our Insight articles and our magazine, InFocus Quarterly. The summer issue of InFocus is up right now. It's entitled The U.S. and Israel Shared Resolve. Again, you can find it all at jewishpolicycenter.org. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. And we support the government of Israel in its determination to secure its borders and its people from the malign forces around it, to secure the release of the hostages, and to marginalize or eliminate the military power of Hamas. The JPC advocates in that regard for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, military security, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. And now our guest. Professor Mark Meyerowitz is professor of humanities at the Maritime College of the State University of New York. He teaches American history, foreign policy, and the Constitution. Mark holds a PhD in political science from Fordham University and a JD from Brooklyn Law School. His domestic courses, I find this interesting, include the Supreme Court and the Constitution, the immigrant experience in America, American women's history, and labor history. But today, we're going to tap into his foreign policy expertise and take advantage of his very deep and broad understanding of Turkey and Turkey's regional interests. The overthrow of Bashar Assad in Syria by the jihadist-oriented HTS, ended one horrifying chapter in Syrian history. It also fundamentally changes the Middle East politically and militarily, including perhaps for Iran. Turkey has a major role in this and other things. So it is with great pleasure that I bring Mark Meyerowitz to you, and we turn the microphone over to him for his expertise and your better understanding. Mark?
Thank you very much, Shoshana. And I just wanted to say more than a shout out to you for our personal relationship, but certainly the work that you do for the JPC is without peer, without comparison, in terms of explaining what these policies are and how all these things operate by the wonderful publications. And of course, I love the webinars and who you select to be a guest. And thank you very much for the unbelievable honor always to work with you. I learned so much from you, and I hope I'll have an opportunity to contribute something today. We have a very, I have to say, the situation in Turkey is in the Middle East and Syria is, you know, it's literally mind-boggling. It changes on a dime. It changes in a moment. And it really, you know, I always, you know, when I wake up in the morning, I go right on to the internet to see if something happened. But always something's happening. But most recently, reflected in a lot of the wonderful questions that were submitted to Shoshana for this program, which I'm going to address, there really seems to be some sign, there's a tectonic shift in the region, but each shift relates to another shift, and I'm going to talk about how things are changing as we speak. So I came up with a little page just with some of the parties that maybe we could put it up if Michael can post it. And It's just the, I say it's the game of Risk because I know we many of us played Risk when we were kids, and really what goes on here is a literally, I mean, I was going to put up a picture of the witches in Macbeth, the cauldron of the Middle East, or Syria as a petri dish for chaos, but I was going to run over the some of the personalities and persons and parties, and then I was going to go in and talk about some of the moving parts, which are highly, highly complicated. Now, you know, as Shoshana pointed out, Bashar al-Assad was overthrown by HTS, which is a fairly small group headed up by this gentleman, or maybe he's not a gentleman, by the name of al-Shara, but his original name was al-Jolani. And what's interesting about that is that really relates to the Golan. And what about that? In that, Mr. Al-Jolani, Mr. Al-Shara's family comes from the Golan. They had olive groves, which were taken away when Israel took over the Golan. And he himself, born in Riyadh, he actually was in Abu Ghraib. He was an ISIS Al-Qaeda participant, a well-known jihadi for many years, who then apparently rebuffed the jihadis. Maybe he did. We don't know, but now, right now, he looks just great. He's a fashionista. He dresses beautifully. Maybe the Turks provided him with some of these outfits. He dresses beautifully. He has a wonderful hairdresser and all of that. He looks great. The question is he great? And somebody actually, I don't remember who said it, but the idea is we got in bed with the devil and we called him a savior. I don't know who is in bed with whom here, but we're with al-Shara, and a lot of people are depending, and a lot of countries and states are depending on him. So really try to understand and discern who he is, what his motives are. Now, just kind of the proof is in the pudding. When he came in, that was really to the benefit of Israel. How did he come in? Well, because Israel came and took out Iranian defenses, took out Hezbollah. Russia was busy with Ukraine. As a result, there was a void. And then Mr. al-Shara is just a local leader in Idlib, a local group. He had maybe 35 or 35,000 or so jihadi fighters. And he was able to topple Assad. But in terms of controlling the entire country, he was unable to do that. No way. And they had to add on additional fighters, many of whom are foreign fighters, including Uyghurs, to boost his power base. But their projection of power was very, very limited. And we know that most recently we've heard a lot about atrocities, which we're going to talk about, against the various minorities in Syria, namely Kurds, Alawites, Druze, Christians, Yazidis, particularly the massacres of Alawites, massacres of Druze by people who are really in the armed forces of Syria, who maybe don't dress that way or pretend not to be. It almost like sounds like the Russian soldiers, if you remember way back, they would go and wear green uniforms and they wouldn't want to dress up like really being. But we know that probably these were Syrian soldiers who went in and massacred minorities. More on that. In terms of the relationship of HTS and al-Jolani al-Shara with the Kurds, who make up a large population in Syria and have control of a region in Syria, including oil resources, water resources, dams. In the Middle East, control of these resources and water is pivotal. So al-Shara met with the head, Mazlum Abdi, the head of the Kurds, the SDF, and they worked up a deal that they would have some sort of reconciliation and that the SDF would become integrated into the military force of Syria. That has not taken place because the Kurdish view was they agreed that they would join but remain unified. The Syrian government says, no, you've got to basically become one piece, one person, you know, just give up, you know, become integrated into our military. Kurds have not agreed to that. And indeed, my understanding is that the Uyghur foreign jihadi fighters, when they joined the military, were not required to break up their cohesion. They were allowed to remain units. That's more on that. Obviously, Turkey, and that's our one of our focuses today. Obviously, Mr. Al-Shara is very much, you want to call him a puppet, a client, whatever you want to call, boosted by, but certainly Turkey has sponsored, let's put it that way, Al-Shara, and most recently signed, they have infrastructure agreements, but signed a defense agreement with Syria, which among other, of course, talks about training, but does not allow Turkey to have bases or take over bases. You might remember, and this is one of the questions, Israel bombed the T4 and Palmyra bases to prevent Turkey from taking over those bases. More, we can talk about that because that's very, very important. In Turkey itself, Turkey has a has had a Turkish terrorist organization, Kurdish terrorist organization called the PKK, which is on the United States terrorist list. And now they have a peace process with the PKK. And their head or founder, Abdullah Öcalan, is in a prison on an island in Emrali, and they're working this out. Open question if this is going to bring peace to the Kurd, to the Kurds in Turkey and to Kurds in Syria. We can certainly talk about that. Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan has been the strongest supporter of al-Shara. And I can say at this point, it's very important to understand that Turkey's position is that al-Shara is the go-to person. Al-Shara should be supported. Let al-Shara unify the country, and that dissolving, allowing all of these other pieces to, in other words, to create a federate, like a Switzerland or a Cantons or federalism, they're opposed to that. Now, what is Turkey's main point? We can kind of explain this some more, but the basic point is this. There are over 3 million refugees from Syria in Turkey. Turks want them back to Syria. The Turks don't like those refugees. They're not happy with them. They take education resources and jobs and you name it. Kind of like maybe what sound of an immigration crisis, not on par to what we have here, but similar idea. And also, Turkey does not want a destabilized Iran because they are worried that if Iran collapses, which could happen, there are millions of Azeris living in Iran. And if they flee, like with Syria, when Syria collapses, Syrian refugees fled to Turkey, the Azeris, which are brothers to Turks will come to Turkey. So Turkey's interest is with a stable Syria. Now, the question is how to achieve that, which we'll talk about. Now, the United States has been pivotal in this issue. President Trump has had very favorable things to say about al-Shara. Indeed, he went to Saudi Arabia, if you remember, and he said, I'm doing MBS a favor. I did it for him. I'm lifting all the sanctions. In reality, the sanctions have not been totally lifted against Syria. There's still sanctions that are renewing every 180 days. But ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Jeanne Shaheen, just went to Syria. And the readout from her meeting, she does say she met with minorities and a monastery and all of that. But she says, we must remove all sanctions on Syria now 100%. What a leap of faith. Senator Jim Risch, the Republican chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, he wasn't on the trip. There was a Republican Congressman, Joe Wilson. But I can tell you, as far as Turkey is concerned, Jim Risch made it very, very clear when Tom Barrack had his nominating hearing as ambassador to Turkey. He said, so long as Turkey has the S-400 from Russia, they will never, so far as I'm here, get the F-35. So less so many moving parts. The one key element in the whole thing is Ambassador Tom Barrack. Very, very important. Friend of the president, very familiar with the region, but extremely supportive of Turkey's positions in Syria, in the Middle East. He says, and listen carefully what he says. He says, what's happening in Syria is a big part due to Turkey's leadership. Israel needs to be redefined. Right? And Turkey is the key, is a pivotal player in all of this, the key on the road. He makes the point that he supports the Turkish position in general about maybe with F-35s and so forth. But in Syria, he supports the al-Shara regime being the key go-to player. Now, what's up against that is what's happening with the minorities. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has made clear the government in Syria has to be inclusive. And also, Jean Shaheen, even in her readout, what's the situation there? Very severe. We know that the Druze were massacred and Israel came in. I even read somewhere that Israel attacked today or yesterday. I don't know if that's correct or not. I just saw something like that. But Israel is worried about, obviously, the treatment of the minorities, but also the fact that, if Turkey comes in and Syria bolsters its military, and here's a fear, and this was in one of the questions that I would just say to think about it. Look, Turkey's a NATO power. And as a NATO power, it's protected by Article 5. And let's be realistic here that if, in fact, there was a situation where, and I don't think this is going to happen, I don't think the United States would ever allow this to happen, but that let's suppose Turkey declared a no-fly zone over Syria. Let's say it said, no more attacks. We're protecting al-Shara. He's our ally. And then there was a skirmish, Article 5. I mean, there's a lot of rumination on this. I doubt that the other allies would then, begin fighting with Israel. But again, there are deconfliction meetings going on, maybe as we speak in Azerbaijan and Baku between Israel and Syria and Turkey. I mean, there is a worry here that there could be a conflict, especially because the Israelis have expanded in the Golan. I say Israel, we're going to talk more about Israel, obviously. Russia had bases in Tartus, a warm water port in Hamamim. And the Russians, according to al-Shara, they can stay, but the Iranians must get out. The Iranians are the bete noire of al-Shara. They tried to kill him repeatedly. They're out. Will they be able to sneak back in? Maybe yes, maybe no. But the Arab states, which I didn't put on the list, it was cut off on the second page, are so pivotal. Why do I say that? Because they had a constitution committee, and the debate was as follows: what should we call this country, the Syrian Republic or the Syrian Arab Republic? The minority said, let's call it the Syrian Republic. And they were rebuffed, and they were pushed down, and they said, no way, we're an Arab country. Now, that's what I think is the main point I would make here. Please focus on this. Syria is an Arab country. My Turkish professor friend emphasizes it's an Arab country, meaning that the Arabs, who under the Ottoman Empire were not very favorable to the Turks, may not wish Turkey to come back in and become the more than just a patron of al-Shara, to be able to control Syria. This is a great and problematic issue for the region. Arab states, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, these are the countries that want to resuscitate, rebuild Syria, hopefully not to the point of conflict with Israel. I would say just the following point. To me, if you want to think about this, you think about it in a train station. There are all these trains going in different directions. And the question is, where is there going to be a train wreck? And how do we avoid a train wreck? And here is where I think the amazing change has taken place recently, which I think is profound. First of all, Tom Barrack, who was criticized by Laura Loomer on X, Laura Loomer, you will remember, criticizes people. And within moments, they are gone. Okay, the president listens to her. And her point was, Barrack, Ambassador Barrack, outrageous that you're supporting jihadists and Islamists in this region. Okay, and we start to hear a little bit of a different, because Tom Barrack's been saying, the Kurds, the SDF, you have to join the military individually. You have to agree to do what you said you'd agree. He's changing his tune on that, maybe to agree to federalism. And the really amazing thing is Syria and Israel. This one is just mind-blowing, honestly, incredible. See, look, al-Shara al-Jolani, he is, we don't know exactly what he is, but He knows that he has a group of people in there who he can't fully control. He can't fully control them. He doesn't control the whole country. And he doesn't want a conflict, right, with Israel. He doesn't want a conflict with Israel. Turkey, right, the way he's approaching Turkey is putting them off. In the Economist interview he gave, he said Turkey can't come in and have bases right away. Turkey was very insistent on that. Pushing Turkey back, if you're al-Shaarah, you're worried, right? And you're wondering whether you can put your future at stake as a client state of Turkey. Is that going to be sufficient in order to allow the regime to survive? And if you see what's going on, you will see that I think that's going to be a very, very difficult thing. Also, the UAE and MBZ has been very, very influential in Syria as well. Again, it's the Syrian Arab Republic. And so, Turkey's policies, and we can talk also about the rest of the Middle East as well, and its position on Gaza and its statements, and more anti-Israel actions like blocking ports and all the things that they're doing. The question is whether those are productive, whether the Gaza policy and making Hamas a freedom fighter is productive. And I don't see it. Thinking more and more about it, al-Shaarah, I don't think, is buying into that whole package. If you buy into that package, you become, in a sense, part of Turkish policy. You risk possibly the future stability of the country. That's as far. I know I was supposed to do 15 minutes. I violated Shoshana's rule, but I just wanted to explain, and we can take down that thing. I think that I just tried. It's so voluminous. So I mean, I don't know. We had a lot of questions, but maybe you have some questions straight up.
Okay, thank you, Mark. I'm not sure it's a game of risk as much as it is a game of throw up all the cards and see where they
Exactly,
land. You know, it's something else. So I appreciate the intro because what you've really done is pointed out a lot of the threads of things that haven't found their resting place yet. They are still threads, they're still moving. One thing you said, I'm going to ask you to go back over a couple of things. One is the deconfliction talks. And there have been talks between Israel and Syria in Paris. There are talks with Israel and Turkey. Are there talks with Israel, Syria, and Turkey? Who's talking? So, and then I'll ask a follow-up question.
I don't I can't I can't I know the answer, but I'm not sure. But the point is, I think it goes in the same direction. Israel and Turkey clearly are deconflicting, no question. And that to me is the number one worry in this region, that Israel and Turkey would come to conflict. As far as Syria and Israel, that one, I'm not so sure Turkey is involved in that one. I don't know. I think that is, if either al-Shaarah, maybe he, now they keep saying he's pragmatic. He's pragmatic. If I were him, I'd be pragmatic because I wouldn't necessarily hook my future onto Turkey because, Turkey is a country. I mean, you don't know where the peace process is going with the Kurds. Where is that going? Is that, are they going to let Öcalan free? I mean, I don't know. Where is that going to be? I should mention just at the moment, I know this is a digression, but President Erdogan has said that he wants to run for another term. And I hate to bring this up, but it's really important. And he's up in 2028. And in order to do that, he needs the votes of the Kurdish parliamentarians. So, in other words, there are a lot of all these moving parts. When you say the deconfliction, I think the deconfliction is on many different levels. Many different levels. But the one that worries me the most is Israel and Turkey. Not so because Syria is not militarily prepared to do anything seriously against Israel. The problem is Turkey coming in with defense agreements and other agreements and having troops there and having a clash. The other agreements we talked about, to me, are the mind-blowing new development that Israel and Syria may want to do. A deal, some sort of a deal, which would not necessarily be in Turkey, is Turkey's favor, or that Turkey would not be in favor of it. But as a pragmatic leader, al-Shaarah, because it's the United States that's saying to him, You certain things you need to do around here if you think you're going to get our support. If you're going to get our support, the things you need to do, maybe not joining the Abraham Accords, but taking actions that give us comfort that you're not just following the jihadi, jihadi menu here, and that you're not a jihadi and you're not an Islamist. The problem with that is that the optics are totally opposed to that, because you have the people going and massacring people. And I always think about this Janus face. I'm not saying he's Janus face, but kind of like looking at the United States, he says, well, I'm pragmatic, I dress nicely, I'm a regular guy. And then his people go and massacre people for no reason other than, going to the Druze and cutting their beards. Can you imagine how disgusting this is? On the internet, people were showing how in Nazi Germany, the Nazis would cut the beards of Jews, and they're cutting the beards, and people, Druze, and many people compared that. That kind of behavior clearly is reprehensible. And the United States, honestly, I think pretty clearly, isn't going to stand for it. If you want us to take away the sanctions, right? Shaheen says, if you want us to put you, we took them off you, Al-Shara. We took them off your country. It has a 180-day fuse. You want them off completely? Well, then you got to move and do the program that you need to do and include and make this inclusive.
Okay, so let me interrupt right there. You said, given the massacres and seeing what's happening, cutting the beards is in fact disgusting. But what's even more disgusting is the number of dead people there are in Soweto and the humanitarian crisis that the Syrians have imposed on Soweto. Israel, of course, defends the Druze to some extent. It's a problem because Israel is busy in Gaza right now. Al-Shaarah has not shown that he's backing off the siege of Soweto and the Druze, and the US hasn't really said anything about it. Maybe we do under the table. Maybe Barack has something to say about it. But from what we can see, the United States has been pretty much hands off. Now, the question that comes from that is, does Al-Shaarah take from this that he actually has a free hand inside of Syria? And if he does, is that likely to start a war with Israel? Even if Bashar is not attacking the state of Israel and the army of Israel, but attacking the Druze, that's really close to attacking Israel.
Well, that presupposes that we know the answer to the following questions. Question number one, did Al-Shaarah intentionally send his people to go massacre the Druze? Don't know that one. Secondly, is this a related point? Are these people who are doing these horrible, despicable things, the murders, the bodies lying in the streets, murdering people, are these jihadis who basically don't support Al-Shaarah? They don't like Al-Shaarah. They don't go by his kind of pragmatic, moderate thing, if it's moderate, to deal with the Israelis. Maybe they are just doing their own thing. We don't know. And if that's true and he can't control them, that's point three, that raises a bigger problem about his ability to maintain a regime. He may not have intentionally, maybe he personally feels, I want to build this place up. I want to make Syria work. And these jihadis out there, they're jihadis. They're going to go and murder and kill and wantonly murder. He needs to be able to control that. How to control that with the Syrian army, is very, very difficult. And he has an issue with the Kurds. They have very good soldiers, but they're not on the program. So he doesn't have who he needs on the program. And he's got these Uyghur foreign fighters, jihadis in there as part of the army. So the answer to your point is imponderable. We don't know, but it seems at least, at minimum, he has lost control over these elements, because there's no way, I don't believe it, that with all the pressure he's getting from the Arabs, from the United States, from UAE and the others, that he is intentionally doing this, because I think they would have just, cut him off. By the way, interesting point. If Al-Shaarah is in charge, he's one guy. What happens when Al-Shaarah is not in charge? What happens if he gets replaced? What happens if the Turks say, well, we don't like Al-Shaarah's positions on this stuff and with the bases, and we'll replace him? He's one person. So we're kind of hinging the whole thing on this one person. So the answer to your incredibly great question is, we don't know, but it's certainly an unacceptable situation that doesn't allow us to proceed to the next point.
Now, to the extent that Israel's Druze have an official position, and they do, they are
They do.
coordinated. It's their view. We did an interview this week with advisor to the spiritual leader of Israel's Druze. They believe it's the army, and they say they have video, and they say they have, guys in uniform who then left and took off their uniforms, and then they came back. I mean, it's their official position. Now, the reason I raise this is not necessarily because they're right, although they certainly may be right. But if that's their position and that's what they say to the Israeli government, and the Israeli government takes them exceedingly seriously, what does that say about the potential future relations between Israel and al-Shaarah if your own community, Israeli Druze, if your own Druze, are saying don't do this or don't trust this or don't help him? It constrains the Israeli government, doesn't it?
I think
I
the
know another impossible question, Mark. I'm sorry.
but I tell you, I hope there's no, I hope I get a good grade in this course. I'm always trying hard. But the point is here, it's just imponderable in the sense that, okay, let's suppose they are in the army. Okay. And very likely they are. I saw a very interesting interview that Ariel Osalan did from I-24 with the chief of the Druze. Was eye-opening, eye-opening, and it clear. I mean, it's the, as we say in the law. I'm a lawyer. Res ipsa loquitur. The thing speaks for itself. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that these people are committing massacres. The question is, if he is in fact directing them, that he has to get out. He has to be out somehow. We can't rely on him. And Tom Barrack's idea, relying on him, or even if he wants a federation. That doesn't fly, okay? The Turkish position is he's the go-to guy. Let's go, let's stabilize the country. And in my opinion, if that's true, then that doesn't fly either. It doesn't fly. But suppose that these are jihadis who are out there in uniforms and they're killing people, and he doesn't have, by the way, his total number of his own people who are loyal to him in his cadre is very small compared to the whole. Call it the army as it is. And he hasn't been able to create a fully integrated army. So we don't know enough. I'm sure the intelligence people know exactly who's who and what's what. But clearly, it creates a dangerous situation, certainly for Israel, because, Israel having to come in and putting itself in harm's way to protect the Druze, which they are doing, which is heroic. Nobody else. This is exactly what the Druze are saying. In Syria, in Israel, nobody else came. Remember, they attacked the Druze. Remember, there was a missile, I think, came from Iran and killed it. And nobody protected us but Israel. And that's just the fact. And it's repeatedly the fact for which Israel never gets credit for all the great things and humanitarian and wonderful things it does. And I just don't want to get upset anymore about how the press and the journalists treat Israel. Look at how. They have come to be the saviors of the Druze against monsters, monstrous people who continuously commit these atrocities. Now, if al-Shaarah is not causing it, then we have to figure out a way to get him to have control so he can prevent it. And this is exactly, I think, what US foreign policy, the Arab states, the Turk, everybody's trying to figure it out in different ways. But, I don't think it helps, for example. To say that Hamas are freedom fighters. I mean, really? If everybody's a freedom fighter, then that doesn't fly. We have to have a right and wrong continuum here. And I think that when you proceed from that idea, then you're lost because then you can't figure out who are the good guys and the bad guys. And clearly here it's obvious.
So, as an aside, I would just point out that the Druze have been a linchpin of a lot of things. You mentioned a missile that killed Druze. It was a Hezbollah missile that
Yes.
killed 12 Druze
That's
children,
right. That's
Israeli citizen Druze children, playing
right.
soccer in the field. Now, what did that prompt? That was it for Israel. That's where the pager strike came from.
I see. I see.
Everything, I mean, the strike was in the works forever. The deal was, the layout was there for a long time. But the precipitating factor that destroyed
Good point.
Hezbollah in Lebanon was that
Good
attack on
point.
the Druze. And it is conceivable, to me anyway, that attacks, continuing attacks on the Druze can have a major impact Because Israel is, as you say, the protector. But let's turn back to Turkey for a minute. And actually, let's leave Syria for a second. You said something else that was very important, in my opinion. Erdogan wants to run for another term. Now, Erdogan is how old? I don't know, he's old.
His 70s, around 70, I think. I'm not sure. I'm not
Oh,
sure.
I'm older
Maybe
than
he's
that.
older.
That's too old.
Maybe he lies about his age. I don't know.
Whatever.
Don't we all?
Constitutionally, he can't run again, right? So this is what was important about what you said,
Right.
that in order for him to run again, he would have to change the rules in Turkey, which means that the parliament has to change the rules.
No, it either I just clarify, either you amend the Constitution or you call early elections. He has options, all of which require a supermajority in the parliament.
Okay, so that goes to the specific. How popular is Erdogan in Turkey, across the board in Turkey? I know he's got pockets of support for sure. How popular? And how strong is his government? Is there a way that he can get the supermajority? Is he failing in the, where does Erdogan stand both with his people and his party and
In
his
order to get the supermajority, although I have to say that I'm still looking at this question because, but he needs the DEM, the Kurdish parliamentarians. He has the AK Party and the Nationalist Party. Now, the question you raise about the, and I think it's doable that to be able to do it, of course, unless there's a conflagration, a problem with the Kurds, and they're working on the peace process. So again, it's a moving target, and we also know that Öcalan is still in prison, and there's a peace process with the PKK. About Erdogan's popularity, I think Erdogan is very popular in Turkey, very popular. And you know, if you look at the elections previously, remember the elections in Turkey? They were very, very interesting. All the pundits in the whole world, including the American pundits, said he's going to lose, but he went to a runoff and then he won. And I'm going to tell you my thinking on why Erdogan is popular and has a tremendous, tremendous vote base. Now, he doesn't have a big vote base in the United States among expatriate Turks. He does not. But in Turkey and many religious Turks and many, huge, huge support. Why? And I think the answer to it, at least it's my idea, is that you see what Erdogan has done for Turkey. Remember, Turkey has always been called the sick man of Europe. It's been always, and you know, it was a subject of treaties where the Europeans came along and they go like, yeah, the Ottoman Empire, well, there, you take this part of Turkey, you take, and they weren't able to succeed. And Ataturk came along and created the Republic. So the idea, the mindset is always one of worry, of phobia about against Europeans and how they don't take them seriously. And what Erdogan was able to do, just think, when Finland and Sweden wanted to get into NATO, who had to agree? President Erdogan. President Erdogan was the one who had to agree. And so what I think Turkey has been able, and President Erdogan has been able to achieve, is to make Turkey a player in the world. He's a player in Ukraine. He supports Ukraine, brought the grain out of the Black Sea, controls the Bosphorus Straits. All the things that he's able to do, he's multitasking in a way that nobody else does. He doesn't support the sanctions against Russia. But all I'm trying to say is that he's a player on the international scene, player. And what I think why Turks voted for him in large part was because Turkey President Erdogan is a player on the world stage. And the leaders of the world have to come to him for approvals and discussions. And he's involved and he's a mediator and all of that. I don't want to overstate it, but from the perception, Turks, I mean, at least this is my take on it, they feel he's kind of overturned this predilection against not paying attention to Turkey and not giving it respect. Okay. And I really believe that's very, very, very important and why he was able to win the first, get to a runoff and then to go to victory. And by the way, the AK Party has lost elections. They have lost elections. But, again, this election coming up, lots of internal issues, particularly because, I mean, let's be candid and realistic. His main opponent was put in jail. I mean, is in jail, in Mamoglu. was an very popular. And not only that, they also invalidated his college diploma, because in order to be president in Turkey, you have to have a college diploma. So they invalidated that. So he's not even eligible anymore, even if he comes out of jail. So again, I leave it to my distinguished audience, and to, of course, to Shoshana, to figure out how does that work, and how do the gears turn around in a system like that. But the answer is that the Kurds and other, there will be a party, the CHP, the Republican Party, will put up candidates, and there will be an election. And you just don't know how it will turn out. But again, but he may run again, no question about it.
So you have the form of elections. They sound a little bit like the elections in Russia. Maybe we're dealing with a neo-czarist Putin and a neo-Ottoman Erdogan. Maybe this is part of the world,
See,
the greatest
don't
empire. We haven't
I
even
don't
talked about, and maybe we won't, talked about Turkey in Africa. We have Turkish troops in Africa establishing bases, establishing control,
Somalia.
aligning themselves with various armies and organizations. So, is Turkey looking for more than respect? I mean, respect is one thing. You can have respect for a small country, you can have respect for all kinds of people. Or is Turkey really looking for control? And that would include Syria, and it would include parts of Africa, and it would include, all kinds of things. If they're looking for control, and this was not in the questions I sent you, but it comes up. Let's see how you are at improvisation. The arrangement between the United States, Armenia, and Azerbaijan has to be seen by Turkey as a little bit of a setback for Turkey and a step forward for the United States. So that was like a huge question.
Yeah, I don't see it there. First of all, about the elections, let's touch that. Elections, I believe in Turkey. I believe, again, that they are, I think, when you show me that they lost elections and that they had to go to a runoff, I think when you say fair, I think fair is not, there's no czarist elections there. The US expatriates voted here like a high percentage against Erdogan. They loaded their votes on a plane. They sent them to Turkey. I know this for a fact from the consul. I mean, I know they did this. They take it seriously. Now, the
Yeah, but
fact
they
is,
jailed the opposition. I mean,
right,
I
that
just
you
get
asked me
that.
about the election process, the part about the opposition, what's to say about it? I mean, it's just, it's unacceptable. I mean, it's unacceptable, although if asking my Turkish friend, they say he committed whatever he committed certain things, and they have a judicial process, and then you have to understand whether judicial process is valid or not, and that's a whole other discussion for another day, and I don't know how to answer that. I don't know how to answer it. It's an almost impossible, but I, as far as the elections themselves and how they operate those elections, I'm not talking about the opponents and all of that. It would appear it has definitely has an element of fairness. Now, a lot of people say it's not fair because, well, the pundits say, well, they have the media is the government, blah 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 blah, et cetera. Okay, there's a lot of discussion on this. At the end of the day, Erdogan appears to be very, very popular, maybe for the reasons I say. I don't think that Turkey is interested in, I don't believe that they're interested in this Ottoman Empire and being, I just don't think so. I think when you say about we talked about the respect, I think that's really, really important. But remember where Turkey is located. It's not a coincidence that they are in the middle, as my Turkish diplomat friend years ago said to me, Mark, we are in a tough neighborhood. What does he mean? They're Asia, Asia, they're Avrupa or Europe, they're right there. They're the southern flank of NATO. They understand. Incirlik, where we had nukes. I mean, can you imagine? This is a hotbed. By the way, speaking of that, just to make sure we remember, we didn't really talk about the US troops in Syria. We should have mentioned that. And the fact that CENTCOM, our soldiers, are still annoyed, upset, and enraged that Turkey did not allow American troops to traverse Iraq in the Iraq War. And that, and CENTCOM fights together with the Kurds, and they find the Kurds to be allies in the American effort to fight ISIS. There are ISIS prisons with families of ISIS members living in that area. Question is, as I've heard it, well, what do you do with them? Answer is, at least not the official Turkish position, but a position that their position is repatriate the jihadis back to their where they come from, and then there'll be less and less and less, and then Turkey can maybe take over the prisons or the government of Syria. I mean, the government of Syria can't take over anything. They can't even, manage what they have. But the bottom line is that's really crucial. You cannot avoid the question of the rise of ISIS and jihadis in Syria and making the fear that Syria could arise as a jihadi state. Anything is possible. This is why I think the various powers we talked about are worried about this possibility. About Africa, I mean, how to evaluate that? I think I'm not sure what the motivation is. I think also Turkey is developing tremendous capacities in production of armaments and drones and military materials. What is the ultimate objective of this? Is it to spread Turkish influence? Is it to create ports? Is that kind of the Chinese thing, is to go around the world? And the Chinese view is much more profound and deep in ideology. It could maybe it's a reaction to the fact that Turkey has not had this opportunity to do this. Also, the development of their diplomatic corps around the world is quite stunning. I mean, they have diplomatic posts all over the world, which they didn't have, and they've expanded that. So I think maybe we can make lemonade out of lemons on this one and think that it's beneficial. If, in fact, Turkey remains a strong NATO ally, a strong ally of the United States, then the things we're talking about are beneficial to the United States and to the West. If it turns in a different direction, then it's very problematic. But I do think if you look, just one additional point, if you look at Turkey and what it's kind of sometimes hard to understand. If Turkey's a NATO member, why is it seeking to be allied with the BRICS or with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization? Why is that? And the reason there, I think, and they've been rebuffed in some of these efforts, and I think that it is because the Turks have not, they want to be involved, they want to be players involved in every aspect of global politics. And they see them. This is why President Erdogan said about the UN that if the world is greater than five, the world is greater than five. You have to read into what he's saying, that the world is greater than five, and Turkey is not getting sufficient, I don't know, love, I don't know what the right word is, or respect or attention. How come these five get all the attention and they get the veto? Turkey should be the one that should be consulted on everything. And I don't think it's a, an aggrandizement. I think it's just coming out of its feeling of being ignored. Maybe.
So I would agree with Erdogan that I'm not sure why France has a veto over anything,
Right.
given its current
Right.
status in the world. So there's a rare point of agreement between me and Erdogan.
Right.
But Turkey is, or at least Erdogan is, I don't know when I want to say Turkey and when I want to say Erdogan, a strong supporter of Hamas and Hezbollah. It's a detractor of Israel, at least in public. And it's put some new sanctions on Israel, and we'll see how that goes. So, is it conceivable that one of the reasons people don't want Turkey in the Security Council and they don't want to give Turkey more than a certain amount of influence in the world is because Turkey makes weird choices? The choice of Hamas over Israel is not a good choice. And I know other countries in Europe are doing it, and they're saying it, but they're saying it mostly to appease their own Muslim populations. Would I choose to be friends with Turkey if Turkey thought the better choices were Hamas and Hezbollah? Now, on the other hand, because there's always two hands, if there were five hands, we'd use them all. Is it better to go with Turkey than to go with Iran? And I think that's the choice that Syria has made also, that Iran is definitely not the player you want. Lebanon is happy enough to get rid of Hezbollah. I don't know if they'll succeed, but they would like to. Is it better to say Sunni jihadists over Shia jihadists? Turkey doesn't have nuclear weapons.
Well, Iran, think about this, and I want to mention something about Azerbaijan. Iran, it was the mortal enemy of al-Shara. So Iran is not, and al-Shara had his first interview, he goes like, Iran is never going to be here again. But Russia, maybe Russia. Okay? Because, and I think there is no trajectory for Iran. In fact, Iran is very weak. And that relates also to Azerbaijan and Armenia and so forth that you mentioned. Remember, Azerbaijan, interestingly enough, is a strong kind of like what my grandson said, hey, bro. They're like brothers. President Erdogan has said about Azerbaijan, it's one nation, two states. Yet at the same time, given Turkey's positions on Israel, Azerbaijan's close connection to Israel, and there are many reasons for it. Certainly, Israel came to their defense with Armenia and so forth. It's quite stunning. It's quite stunning, and I think it's quite sincere. And the whole thing with Azerbaijan and Armenia and so forth. I mean, negotiated this Turk, you know, this I think the trip was that it
Yeah,
the
sure.
special road, the Trump Road for International Peace and Prosperity. I love it. Look. I mean, Azerbaijan. Turkey and Armenia have to reach. They had an agreement to agree. They need to be peace in these areas. But a lot of these disputes are ancient, old disputes. They go back, which raises the point that you raise about Hamas. Well, you see, the thing about this is, why is this point about Gaza and Hamas? Because it does resonate strongly in the Turkish population. I mean, it just does. And that is more that resonates, the more support. It's used as a way, which is, in political science, take an external conflict and, avoid whatever you're thinking about internally and just focus on Israeli, quote, atrocities. This is what they're doing in, look at Gaza. And the coverage on the media in Turkey is endless. It's almost like NPR, it's endless screeds against Israel. And it resonates. I mean, I would do a panel with a Turkish university and have a panel on Palestine and the we do one on Syria. I talk on Turkey, Syria, et cetera, Turkish professors. And a Turkish professor starts going off on atrocities and Gaza, Israel's doing that. That's not even political science. So what I'm trying to say is that this feeling has permeated the population and has energized the population, which is helpful. When you are coming to an electoral situation, you want to boost your party. So I think it's that I hate to say pragmatic, but there's a certain pragmatism in the support of Hamas. How can you take the position? And this is something I've come up with, and I'm reluctant to say it, but it's a good point, I think. The whole debate, actually, Israel kind of jumped into this by. I think Netanyahu used the word genocide in connection with Armenia, if I remember correctly, in the last couple of days, and it created a firestorm. And there's always the feeling that Israel sure did not do that because it will excite Turkey. But the genocide word, which is used as freely as, I don't know, peanut butter and jelly sandwich. What a crazy idea I just said. But my point is, the Turks have always said, we didn't commit genocide in Armenia. That's not right. And in a way, I'm a big believer in the fact that the Holocaust was a genocide. The word genocide should not be used except after very, that's another discussion, I understand. But if you believe that people are falsely accusing you of genocide, then turning around and accusing them of genocide when there isn't any genocide, obviously. Look at the International Court of Justice, what they said, particularly the dissenting opinion. I have an article on the Jewish Policy Center, you can read it. On the dissenting opinion of the Ugandan judge that under no circumstances did Israel commit genocide under the international law, under the law of the ICJ or otherwise. So Turkey's position in calling Hamas a freedom fighter and accusing Israel of genocide. I mean, it just doesn't have any viability to it, especially if you, Turkey, say to the world, don't you dare accuse me of genocide in Armenia, to which is a debate. I'm happy to debate at any time. To me, the Holocaust is genocide. You have to watch how you use words, freedom fighters, and all these words, genocide. These are highly inflammatory words that need to be used carefully with discretion. And so if you're going to accuse, then you don't then stop being, upset about being accused of the same thing if you don't think it's viable. So I think the answer to your question, long-winded as it was, is that it resonates in the populace very, very much, is reinforced in the media, and it has legs. It really has deep legs, and it has also done that around the world, okay? By the way, obviously, regretfully about Gaza. But there in Turkey, it's just a definite tipping. It's definitely impactful.
So, always trust your listeners, or in your case, your students, to come up with something that makes practical sense and puts a perspective on an issue. So, we got a comment from a listener. See, I don't
Yes.
put them on the air, but I do read their comments. And
Of
Tom,
course.
thank you. He points out that the population of Turkey at 85 million is the largest population in Europe, excluding Russia. And that Turkey's GDP has doubled in the last 5 years. It's larger growth, excuse me, than any other top 10 European state. Turkey is trying to flex its new muscles. That makes perfect sense to me. It is actually a non-political, non-ideological way to view Turkey as well. I am not erasing the political and I'm not erasing the ideological because I think Erdogan is hugely ideological. But if you're the Turkish people, and Turkey has all kinds of people in it, and they represent all different political opinions. The fact that your country is huge and your economy has doubled, your GDP has doubled in the last week, all of that stuff makes you say, regardless of your opinions about Israel or Hamas or anything else,
Right.
we are important. We, Turkey, we are important. And that, it seems to me, accounts for a lot of the support for Erdogan. Even beyond the political and the ideological. So, thank you to
Yeah,
the listener who
well,
sent
I
that in.
would thank the listener. I would also say that, as far as I understand, inflation is very high and the lira is way, way, way down. I remember when I went to Turkey, you could buy something. Today, Turks are bemoaning that. And also, I would say, not to be, not to keep being critical about this point. Yes, it's true. They have a burgeoning economy, all of that. Yes, but the lira is way down. And remember the earthquake, remember the aftermath of that. There's a lot of stuff going on, and there's a lot of poverty in the country. So I think that, yeah, it's always true. It's the economy stupid, and absolutely true. If the economy's good, that helps politicians, no question. High GDP. Hi, everything, very nice. But the economy itself, in its underlying kind of like, there's kind of, I don't remember the, there's kind of an interest rate that I can't really remember the name of, but it sits below the economy. It's kind of a building block of the economy. And many economists feel it's in great danger in Turkey. And I don't know, and I'm not an economist. So I would say, I hope their economy grows, and I hope that it will grow in a way that they can reach a way to get back with Israel and do the trade and do all the things that they were doing. I mean, Turkish Airlines was sending more people to Israel than El Al. I mean, give me a break. So, I'm hoping that that will happen. And I am going to be a very, very guarded optimist.
So we're coming to the end, but here's one that just came up. Speaking of Turks coming to Israel and all of that good stuff that was happening, Israel also was taking Turkish ships with oil dock in Haifa Harbor and transporting it across Israel to Jordan during the Syrian civil war because the transit
Right.
lines didn't work as well. So not all of it, but some of it would go down here and it would go across. And Jordan was happy, and Israel was happy, and Turkey was happy. Do you know if that's still happening?
I don't know about that one. I
Because it
know that
seems to me
something
that it.
about the Azerbaijani oil that's still
No,
flowing.
not on that side, but.
Oh, no, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, because it.
I would think, although the thing is if it's happening with ports. I don't know, because I know that the Turks have shut, each country has shut down the port. So I don't know. I don't know. I don't, you know, I wouldn't even, pers wouldn't think about it.
We need to find that one out, and we need to ask listeners if you have some
Sure.
knowledge of this, it would be helpful. But I do remember that that was a kind of good way for Turkey, Israel, and Jordan to be cementing minimally trade relations and
Well, there's
maximally
no question that there's
political relations.
intelligence cooperation and all sorts of things going on that we're not aware of. and it is not a total complete train wreck and needs to be repaired. But clearly, both, certainly Turkey, is they understand the implications of how this goes further south is in no one's interest whatsoever.
So, some of the European countries are having that thought too, as they claim they
Exactly.
don't want intelligence or military cooperation with Israel. And Israel says, "Well, you mean you want us to turn off the intelligence cooperation?" And the British said,
Exactly.
"No, please, not that." So, Mark, we've come to the end of the hour, and this was amazingly informative and interesting, and gives us a perspective on who the players are and what the players want, and to some extent, an understanding that Syria is not altogether an independent player. It may wish to be, and the United States, I think, would like it to be under Assad. But we've learned an awful lot here. And you've been across this program fairly optimistic on the subject of Turkey itself. So people who listen know I always try to go out on an optimistic note. So if
Right.
you looked at the region, and you looked at Turkey under Erdogan today, given what it's doing in Syria and how it's operating, given its relations with Israel and how it's operating, given the economy and how it's operating or not operating, are you optimistic about the future of Turkey as a positive player in the Western world, helping to elevate Western interests, broad Western interests? Are you optimistic about Turkey?
Well, as I said, I'm guardedly optimistic, but I do believe the following. I believe that, and I've been thinking a lot about this, with all of these developments that we've talked about, right? I think that the Turkish leadership is going to give some further thought to these directions and where they're going. Because, in other words, the efficacy of some of the things that they're doing, like Hamas and all these other things that they've been doing, effective. They're not effective. They're not effective. They're not boosting Turkey as a country in all the ways that we've talked about, politically, economically, militarily. And the question is, are they focusing on where they're going in the future? And that's kind of tricky with all these other internal things going on, not just the external things going on. So I would say that I would be I'm nostalgic about the halcyon days of Turkish-Israeli relations, which were really, really wonderful. If you talk to diplomats from Israel who were in Turkey, you can't imagine how the close cooperation and all the things that were going on. I think that I'm going to say optimistically, then God willing, the crisis in Gaza and the hostages come back, and we're over at least that for the time being. And hopefully, God willing, and can stop the war, and Israelis can get back to normal life, all the things we pray for. That at the same time, that the trade, because even in all the tough times, the trade was never canceled. We're in a very fraught time between Turkey and Israel. There's no question about it. And I have to say, to be very candid about it, Turkey wants certain things from the United States. And fact of the matter is, President Trump has shown incredible leadership in every, India, Pakistan, R Congo, Rwanda, you name it. And I think this one here will be very important to try to bring these parties together. Because my last thing is, I remember meeting a guy in Turkey in Istanbul. And he goes to me like, Mark, we like the same things, Turks and Israelis. We like the same food. We like the same things. We need to get together. And that is the feeling, I think, of Turkish elites and people in business to be able to make business and do business and all the advantages of having a relationship with Israel. So I'm going to be optimistic that better times are hopefully ahead between Turkey and Israel. I hope so, because I think it benefits Turkey so much to have that relationship and not going down a rabbit hole with Hamas. Hamas is the rabbit hole of disaster for Turkey, and it is not a future for Turkey.
So, being the cynic and the skeptic that I am, I would just point out that Israel and Iran had great relations
That's true.
until they went down the rabbit hole, and they went down their own rabbit hole. But there was a time when Israel and Iran were very good friends. And I don't mean the times of Cyrus the Great, I mean in the 20th century,
Absolutely.
until they went down the rabbit hole. So, I'm going to end by saying, I hope I'm wrong. I hope you're right. And thank you for a great program.
Thank you.
To the viewers, next week, we're going to try parsing Lebanon. Good luck to us. Thank you, Mark.
My pleasure, privilege, and thank you, Shoshana, so much.